From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today's show is all about great authors. We'll hear interviews with people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Karen Hall. We've talked to a number of great writers about their craft. Earlier this month, I spoke with SCAD professor Jonathan Rabb about his latest book, Among the Living. In his novel, the main character is a Holocaust survivor who moves to Savannah. He told us how a family experience helped shape that main character.
I had a cousin. In fact, I dedicate the book to my great uncle and aunt and cousin who all miraculously survived the war. And my cousin was only 9 years old when he was in a camp. And I would see him from moved to New York. He was there. And we would have breakfast many, many mornings. And he was an accountant. He was living a normal life. But you could see that there was something, obviously, that was still shattered inside.
This part was very interesting to me because nobody knows what to say to him, Itzhak. And it's almost as though he himself doesn't know what they should be saying. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the Holocaust. It just reminded me of pretty much anyone who's lived through a horrific tragedy of some kind.
Any kind of trauma. What are you supposed to, and you have your sort of list of things. There's a scene in the book where people start asking him, what was it like? And internally, he's thinking to himself, you know, all right, here are the questions. I'll answer them the way I usually do. And at a certain point, they get to the question. And inside he said, in his head, he says, here it comes. I know it's going to come. And the question always is, how could you have not known? How could you have not gotten out? And, you know, that I think is one of the questions that people always ask of people going through traumas. And I always bring up the example of, I was living in New York with my wife in 2001, and walking down the streets in August, none of us were thinking to ourselves, gosh, you know, in about a month, the whole world is going to change. You're not aware of these epic things that are going on, and history just sort of moves you along. How could you not know? How could you not get out? It's almost a nonsensical question at a certain point, and yet you have to answer it. He's still just trying to find his way. And I think you sort of turn on an automatic pilot at a certain point to confront those kinds of questions.
That was author Jonathan Rabb. His new book is Among the Living. You know, we love hearing from you, and we especially love hearing your suggestions for great books. So call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or find us on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Novelist Terry McMillan uses a familiar creative device to help many of her female characters face their fears, reinvention. We saw this with protagonist Savannah Jackson in the New York Times bestseller Waiting to Exhale. When readers met her, she'd just relocated to Phoenix from Denver, and she'd taken a pay cut for a new job in a place she believed will bring excitement and romantic opportunities. We see the theme of reinvention again in Georgia Young. She's the main character in I Almost Forgot About You. That's Terry McMillan's latest novel. I spoke with her in June about this work, and here's a portion of that conversation.
You know, there aren't a huge number of celebrity authors. I include you in that, but that's been around for a long time. Charles Dickens was a celebrity author. But when you are among that fairly small number of people, how do you still maintain your craft?
I don't write thinking that, oh, wow, this book would make a great film. I'm more concerned about, I mean, I take the characters that I write about very seriously and their lives and the situations that they're in and their emotional framework, all of it. I do a lot of research to make sure I know who these people really are and what they're going through and what their dilemma is. And I am not thinking, I don't even think about myself when I'm writing. I think about the people on the page because their lives are what's important to me when I'm writing, when I'm trying to tell their story, which is why most of my books are character driven. I really have to let myself go in order to jump inside of their skin. And when I do that, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner or Hollywood. I'm not there. That's the last thing on my mind. Even when I finish a book, even though this one I think would make a good movie. only because, but it might not. I mean, if it does, fine. If it doesn't, it's okay.
What is that like, that losing yourself? What's that process? What does that feel like? What is that like when you sort of lose yourself in the characters you're like writing.
Well, I think I would like to think that most writers do that. Otherwise, how can you get inside of them? I do these profiles of my main characters so that I know so much about them, probably more about them than I do myself. I know what grades they got in elementary school and their favorite color and what upsets them and how many times they've been in love. Do they lie? Do they cheat? Do they steal? What's their biggest secret? And what they wish they could change, what they wish they could fix. And if they could be someone else, who would it be? What they like about themselves and what they don't like. And what their biggest challenge is right now in this story at this very moment in time. And from there, I go. I know their astrological signs.
Huh. How difficult is it then to let go of these characters once you've finished writing?
I wake up in the morning when I'm in the throes of telling a story, and I mean, I can't wait to find out what they're going to do that day and what's going to happen. I don't know. And I just let them, it's like I'm like the conduit. You know, the story filters its way through me and it comes out on my fingers on that keyboard. But I see it, I'm listening to them, I'm hearing what they're saying, I'm watching, and I'm feeling what they're feeling. I'm putting myself in their shoes. Otherwise, it's just really phony. And I'm just telling you their story from my perspective, and that's not what I do. I don't think a lot of writers do that. Or if they do, you can tell they're showing off. And I don't write to show off. My characters' lives, I take them very seriously, even though there's humor in my book, because I know depressed people who still laugh. Hmm. You know, and you can still find some joy in some things, just not maybe a lot of it. But, you know, we're all going through something, and I just pick characters that are on the... They're on the brink of making some kind of... They have to do something, or things are going to stay the way they are. And the way they are is not what they're pleased about.
So have you ever...
Like most of us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wonder, since you're talking about how you can't wait to find out what's happening to them, have any of your characters really surprised you with...
Oh, yes.
Can you give...
Georgia.
Your new Dr. Georgia Young in the newest book.
Yeah.
Which part surprised you?
I don't want to tell it.
Oh, it's a giveaway, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things, but for the most part, I mean, I was shocked. I was like, "Okay, Georgia, do your thing. I'm just typing what you're telling me to say and what you're doing, and I'm going along with it. That's it." That's how I know I'm not trying to, it's not a crossword puzzle. And I'm not trying to design a story or make my characters do what I want them to do. They tell me what they want to do, and I just respect them and I listen to them because they become real people. They are three-dimensional people by the time they're on this page. And I just follow their journey, and I'm not going to have a character do something that's out of character. It doesn't work that way. I mean, sometimes as real people, we do things that are out of character, but we often pay for that.
But do you want to return to any of these characters and find out what happened to them next after the end of the book?
No, I tried that with Waiting to Exhale, and I was pleased with it, but I was writing a different story, and I realized that the women where I left them at Waiting to Exhale, it lent themselves to the story that I wanted to tell. And so I told it. Getting to Happy. But other than that, no, because there is no, everything isn't like some gift that's just wrapped up in the end. Usually I would think that a character, if they're at D on the alphabet, if they get to F by the time the story's over, they've made progress. And I don't care on what level it is. It could be emotionally, physically, whatever. But something, there's been movement in their lives, and they're better after the story ends than they were when it started. I have no idea where that's going to end up, but all of our problems cannot be solved.
If you're just joining me, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Terry McMillan. Her latest novel is called I Almost Forgot About You. How do you choose what to read from your books? When you're going to read an excerpt at a book talk, how do you pick?
Well, let me tell you, that's what I'm going through now. It has to be early in the book because some things later don't make sense.
Yeah.
So it's usually about at least, in this case, probably the first four chapters, maybe five. But in order for them to make sense, there's certain parts of the first chapter that I have to read. So that's why I'm trying to juggle how I'm going to do this. But also, I'm going to, I think, 15 cities. I can't stand reading the same thing at every reading. So I'm going to juggle it just to break it up, because otherwise they start getting on my nerves because I know they aren't real.
Do you do the book tours? Do you have to grit your teeth to do them?
Oh, no. The only thing I'm gritting my teeth about now is if my clothes are going to fit in my garment bags. Seriously, I had to throw them on the floor today to see. Sometimes you have to do television interviews, and you have to do things sometimes during the day, and then in the evening you do a reading. But I love, that's the best part of this, is the audience. It's the best part of all. I love standing in front of an audience and this call and response thing that happens a lot of times in Black churches. And sometimes people will, and Black women in particular, will say, "Girl, I hear you," or "Say it again." And I mean, it's so much fun.
They call out while you're reading?
Oh, yeah. They'll say, "Preach, tell it," or whatever. And women have, yeah, women do this, for years they've been doing this. I expect it. If there is no reaction, I know something is wrong. Oh, but for the most part, I love reading aloud. And plus, I change my voice, the inflection, everything. I can sound like a guy. I can sound like a little kid. But I've learned over the years that I do this without really trying to do it. It's not a conscious thing. I've done it over the years. And it's actually a lot of fun. But that's how I hear it when I'm writing it. If I'm writing from a child's point of view, it's not me writing as an adult from trying to figure out what I've become 6 years old.
And you hear the voice in your head while you're writing?
Yes, yes, yes. And in this book, I had these little twins. And I've been around kids, so I sort of know the difference between a six-year-old and an eight-year-old. And what they say and don't say, and the knowledge that some of them have, even though some of them now are a lot smarter, but these kids were too. But that's the beauty of it, and the questions that people ask. It's a very intimate thing, regardless of how many people are in the audience. It's very intimate, and you don't get that when you're sitting in front of your computer telling a story.
That's bestselling author Terry McMillan. Her latest novel is called I Almost Forgot About You. It's available now. This is On Second Thought. There are some bummed out people in Atlanta this morning. National Book Award winner Ta-Nehisi Coates was scheduled to speak to a sold out audience at the Leadership Atlanta event today. However, he had to cancel because of a scheduling conflict. We hope this next segment might ease the disappointment. I spoke with Ta-Nehisi Coates about a year ago. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant the day after our conversation. And the news that Marvel Comics tapped him to write a new storyline for the Black Panther series had just been released. But we started our conversation with what he's best known for, writing about race. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but we have nearly a quarter of the world's prisoners. Most of those incarcerated today are Black. That inspired Ta-Nehisi Coates to write a piece for The Atlantic called The Black Family in the Age of Mass Incarceration. He spent a lot of that piece on the Moynihan Report. That's a famous document by sociologist Daniel Moynihan that singled out single Black mothers as the biggest barrier to economic equality for African Americans back in 1965. That's been decried as racist victim blaming, but it's also been praised for its unique analysis of how family structure affects poverty levels. I asked Ta-Nehisi Coates if he could defend that controversial report without defending Moynihan himself.
Well, it's tough to articulate that. I think here's what I would say. I think the Moynihan Report was misread and has been misread for the past 50 years. But I think even within the kernel of the report, for instance, people, you know, said that Moynihan was basically a racist, that he was blaming the victim. I think all of that is pretty much wrong. But I think within the Moynihan Report itself, and more so within the career of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you can see the seeds for why we made a certain policy choice to deal with the problems in the African-American community through the lens of incarceration, as opposed to all the other, you know, myriad of ways that we could have dealt with it in the African-American community.
The Moynihan Report was published in 1965. The official title was The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. I wonder if you think that report was sort of the source for what we hear all the time, which is, where are the fathers? We're constantly hearing that these days when they talk about issues in among African-American families. Did it start with Moynihan?
No, it didn't start with Moynihan. In fact, there's a long history of sociology. I have a short post about this on The Atlantic, but there's a long history in sociology, in psychology, of looking at African-American families and deeming them what Moynihan called matriarchal. And that has a very, very negative history as far as I'm concerned, because a significant part of that is positioning Black women as problems in the lives of African-American families. Black women have too much power. And so in the run-up to the Moynihan Report, pulling from, you know, all of this sociology and psychology, he is actually advocating that jobs that Black women have be given to Black men, and Black men be pushed out, Black women be pushed out of the way, so that we can prop up a proper patriarchy in the African American community. So he's not the source of it. He's the one that gained the most attention for it, but he's certainly not the source of it.
So I wanted to play you this clip from President Obama earlier this year. He granted clemency to 46 men and women who've spent some of them decades in prison for nonviolent drug offenses. Two of them are from Georgia. Take a listen.
These men and women were not hardened criminals, but the overwhelming majority had been sentenced to at least 20 years. 14 of them had been sentenced to life for nonviolent drug offenses. So their punishments didn't fit the crime.
Now, your piece is long, it's extraordinarily well-researched, and you're sort of tracking the history and the effects of mass incarceration, and I don't want to try to sum it up here. I'd rather people go read it. But I wanted to talk about this particular point, because we are seeing some reform here, and whether or not you think reforms in sentencing will address some of the problems that you talk about.
It'll address some of them, but it will not be sufficient. You know, I think politicians are in a difficult, you know, place. So, you know, you obviously are responsible to a public. And so the first thing you try to deal with is the stuff that's going to be done that will generate as little controversy as possible. And so I think that's why when we hear reformists talk, we often talk about nonviolent drug offenses or nonviolent criminals who've been sentenced to, you know, some ridiculous amount of time in prison. But the vast, vast majority of people who are imprisoned in this country are not in the federal system where the president has power. They're actually in the state system. And the majority of those people, if you looked at it, a significant number of those people are not there for drug offenses and are not there for nonviolent offenses. Even what we would deem to call nonviolent and violent deserve some interrogation in terms of where we draw the line. And so I think it's good. I don't think it'll be sufficient. I don't think it addresses the fact that, you know, in this country, we've had a policy of creating criminogenic communities in the African-American community. And I think that that has to be part of the conversation, too.
Well, one of the things that you touch on a number of times, and it's surprising to me how often the research into crime and punishment does not match the policies that are decided on in our legislatures, both state and federal. And it's what you call rhetoric instead of scholarship. A lot of it is about not knowing the facts. And I wonder if you think that is entirely politics. Is this about people ignoring facts in order to score political points?
That's a significant part of it. I mean, I don't want to pretend like crime was not up, for instance, in the early 90s when we got the 94 crime bill. It was. There's just no question about that. The question is how we decide then to respond. What we've seen over the past 40 years is a situation in which crime has gone up, starting roughly in the late 60s, early 70s, and then began to decline in the late 90s into, you know, our current era. That's actually an international trend. That's not just the United States. Now, we don't quite know why. We don't know exactly what happened. But here's what we do know. The United States is unique in responding to that problem with a solution of mass incarceration. Canada, for instance, which experienced a very, very similar phenomenon, did not then decide to jail massive numbers of its citizens. Our solutions, I think, are just devoid of context.
My guest this morning is Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His latest book is a letter about being Black in America, written to his son. It's called Between the World and Me. And next spring, he will add another, to me, very impressive title to his resume, comic book author. Marvel has selected him to write a new storyline for the African-American superhero Black Panther. This is what's called geeking out. Ta-Nehisi, from what I understand, I mean, have you been reading? Do you actually read comic books in real life?
I have... read comic books all my literate life. I do have to correct you, though. This is so nerdy. It's embarrassing. He's actually not African-American. He's Black, but he's
yeah,
African.
Yeah, you're right. He's African. He's actually the fictional trial of Wakanda.
I got to get it for all my African brothers and sisters out there who are screaming.
That's right, because he's from the fictional tribe, the king yeah. of Wakanda. And in fact, he's Black Panther is a title. It's not a name. It's a title conferred... Yes. On the king. We're going to geek out here together for the next few minutes.
Okay, I hear it. I hear it in you.
So here's the thing, Ta-Nehisi. This makes you a real outlier at Marvel. The company has taken, I think, justifiable criticism. They have very, very few writers of color there. And I wonder if that puts extra pressure on you. Do you feel the need to succeed in order to prove that writers of color can?
No, Celeste, I always feel the need to succeed. I don't want to suck. I don't like sucking. I don't like failing. I don't like doing things poorly. It should be a great book. That's what should happen. And so I don't know how I would look at it if I were white. I mean, that's a totally different world. But I think that my desire to do it really, really well and to produce something great is probably independent of any sort of concerns about diversity.
So the Black Panther seems to me a perfect fit for you. This is a character, probably one of the best arcs in all of comic books, is from the 1970s, the Panther versus the Klan. And, of course, there was also a really famous arc in which the Panther fought the South African government over apartheid as well. So what kind in what ways do you think the Black Panther has maybe always been associated with social issues?
Well, he was found, you know, he comes around in the 60s, you know, at a time where there aren't that many where there aren't any really Black superheroes at all. So that right there in its origin makes him, you know, revolutionary. He's in Africa, you know, folks have all sorts of views about Africa and Black people and race. So, as it is with all of us who walk through the world, it is with him in fiction. It's not even a choice. It's very hard for him not to be political in any sort of way.
And another thing is that from the very beginning, was sort of designed to break stereotypes. We're talking about somebody who, yes, he's a superhero, right. He's a tracker, but he's also has a PhD in physics from Oxford University. Right. He's considered to be one of the 8 smartest people on the planet.
Talented Tim.
Yeah, he's an inventor as well. With that kind of character who's supposed, I mean, I guess he's kind of the best at everything that he possibly does. How do you approach that as a writer? Because isn't there a need to also introduce fallibility?
Yeah, you got to find a human in him. You know, you got to find a human. And one of the good things is that there have been people who have been writing him before me who've done a pretty good job of that, that I can build on. But he can't be an after-school special. You know, it can't be something that you pull out at Black History Month. You know, he can't be an exemplar. He's got to be a human being. And I think that's what you do.
So I wonder how you think he's different from many of the superheroes like Thor and Captain America that we've been seeing in the movies, because there is a Black Panther movie coming.
Right.
But Joshua Rivera wrote this about this character in GQ. He wrote, he's not really a superhero. First and foremost, he's a king. He acts on behalf of a people the world resents and tries to control. This sets him apart from characters like the Avengers in a tangible, sometimes contentious way. He holds the world accountable. What's your thought on that?
He's a king. He's a king, and not only his title is king hereditary. His title is Black Panther is hereditary. That's very, very different than say Captain America, you know, or Spider-Man or any other number of superheroes. Here is somebody that was born into this and is descended from generations of it, and so carries a particular weight an ancestral way, which is, you know, again, in itself a metaphor for all of us throughout the diaspora, that I think some of the other characters don't really carry.
So there, like I mentioned, there is a Black Panther movie in the works. I think that so far they've said Chadwick Boseman might play him,
right.
Who a lot of people know for the James Brown movie biopic. And I wonder if you are writing with that in mind. Are you writing a year-long arc thinking, could this become a movie?
No. I mean, that's not up to me, you know. But I you know, it's funny. I always say this, you know, I feel very, very sorry for people who interact primarily, especially for Marvel, with Marvel superheroes through movies before they interact with them through comic books. I think comic books are a superior form for conveying superheroes and superhero dumb. And I, you know, I like the movies. I go see the movies. But in no way do they ever replace the comic books at all.
You're kind of biased, though, because you're a writer.
I am. That's true. But, you know, I think I have a good argument. I think what books and what literature in general does, the special thing about it is how it interacts specifically with one reader, and the reader is left there to, you know, feel a certain way or see certain things as they see it. The book really becomes their own. And I think comic books is much the same way. You read it, you assume certain things about the voice, you hear it a certain way in your head, you make these sort of logical connections between pictures, and you make it the way you would make it. You know, and it gives you a kind of ownership over the form that I think movies can't really give.
So you've said that you think comics have really important cultural value, even beyond just what you've talked about in their value to the reader. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's no mistake that, you know, they're successful. Even though I just finished saying all this about movies, you know, it's no mistake that this is our you know, one of our most successful movie genres right now. It's no mistake at all. These are our myths. I mean, that really is the bottom line. And for me, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me as a young man, as a young African-American in West Baltimore, to pick up Marvel Comics and see, you know, say a Storm, or to see, you know, a Black Iron Man as he was at the time, or to see a Black Panther, it was just a tremendously enriching experience. And it didn't have to be a situation where Hollywood had to think and decide whether they could bank on, you know, such and such to carry the role. And the artist decides to draw it, and we'll see what happens.
We only have about a minute left, but I wonder if you would also consider writing a comic for a non-Black character. Would you all, I mean, if you could choose another character to write for, who would it be?
I don't think I should say, but yes,
why?
I would consider that.
Why can't you say?
I don't think I should. Don't tell the world.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of Between the World and Me. The book won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2015. He's also a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and the pen behind the latest Black Panther story arc for Marvel Comics. I spoke with him last year. It's a celebration of writers today. We learn something new every time an author appears on this program, and some of our favorites are from Georgia, like mystery writer Karen Slaughter.
As much as I love my readers, you know, it's been great going to libraries and bookstores these past few weeks and meeting them and talking to them. I never think about them when I'm writing. It's just me and the story. And I am a prolific reader of crime fiction, thrillers, all kinds of books, really. I'll read anything. And I write the story that I would like to read.
And that's it?
That's as simple as it is, yeah.
And when you get to the end of the book, do you then think about, gee, maybe this is too much for someone else?
You know, I don't. But it's interesting because I get a lot of readers across different generations, men and women. And I think that actually young women who grew up watching CSI and all these crime programs, and there's a real appetite for them, and they're very savvy and they want to know the truth. And I don't take shortcuts in my book. You know, I'm not going to make up some scientific thing to make the story move more expediently. I really talk to police officers. I talk to forensics experts. I talk to medical examiners and doctors. And I want it to be as realistic as possible. That's a really important component to me of the novels. I don't want someone who's a nurse to say, wait a minute. That never happens. You know, I want it to have that realistic feel. And, you know, I think it's important and that people appreciate that. And that's, Obviously what they want to read.
How limiting is that, though? Are there times when you're tempted to take a shortcut?
You know, I have to honor what's going on in the medical field or whatever I'm writing about. But I think everybody understands that you can't write a textbook. You know, I had one, I asked my doctor who advises me about putting in a chest tube, and it was 16 pages, right? And I had to make it two paragraphs. So, you know, I think that they understand, but they know that I'm trying to get everything right.
If some of history's greatest artists could go back in time and redo their work, would they? Would Michelangelo maybe use different colors in the Sistine Chapel, or would Beethoven change a couple notes in the Fifth Symphony? My next guest has spent the last 20 years agonizing over her masterpiece. Karen Hall released her debut novel, Dark Debts, in 1996. It told the story of a Georgia family tormented by the devil, and it was an instant success. Most best-selling authors would move on, applaud their own success, and start on the next book. Karen Hall did not do that. She says she couldn't. Dark Debts has continued to capture her imagination all these years later, and now the story is getting a new life. Dark Debts has been re-released with some major plot changes and a new ending. Karen Hall joins us this morning from the studios of WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. Karen, it's a pleasure.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, I mean, the first question everyone must ask you is what was it about the original version of the novel that you couldn't let go of?
There were several things, and one was just the protagonist was not done with me. So whenever I'd try to write something else, I just kept hearing his voice. But pragmatically, I just knew that I had become a better writer, and I wanted to make the book better. And there was also the fact that when I wrote the book, I had converted to Catholicism not long before the book came out. And so my take on it was really simplistic. And as I learned more and knew that more, I felt bad about it. And I wanted to be able to go back and, you know, I can't do it justice in terms of how complicated it is, but I wanted to be able to show a broader view.
You also took, in the new version, it's a little less gory. You took out a particular killing spree. I'm trying to be very careful and not give anything away, okay, either about the original version or the new version. But you did choose to take out some fairly violent scenes. Why?
You know, I took out the really gory scene because I just didn't feel like I needed it. And I guess the first time around I thought I did. But it just seemed to me that what was going on really had more to do with the main characters and what was going on inside them. And also I had had some complaints from people who didn't like the fact that one of the protagonists basically got away with murder, you know, by saying the devil did it. And I didn't know how I felt about that. So I thought since I didn't need it, I would just take it out.
Okay. So your sister is a novelist as well. She's published,
yes,
11 books.
I think so.
I
stopped counting at some point.
I went in and counted for you.
Okay,
Karen.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Come to Thanksgiving dinner at my house.
I'm not a bad mediator if there's arguments, but you spent 25 years, which is a quarter of a century, on this one novel. Is this something that you talk about with your sister?
Not really. I talked to her about it a lot when I wrote it the first time. And I talked to her about it so much that she finally wouldn't talk to me about it anymore.
And, really?
And yeah, she said, shut up and write the thing. So that actually was the best advice anybody ever gave me. So I shut up and wrote it.
So your sister is Barbara Hall.
Yes.
And she is not just a novelist, but she, like you, is also a writer for TV. And I found it interesting, and please do tell me if this is not accurate. But from what I understand, when you were quite young, you were kind of, sort of, in a way, discovered by Alan Alda?
I was in college, and I took a summer school class and went out to California, and we met with various people, and he was one of the people that we met with. And I remember I told him that I was missing a premiere of a play I had written that my community theater was doing so that I could go out there to meet him. And so he asked me to send him the play, so I did. And then he actually called me at my sorority house, which was interesting because nobody believed that it was really him. And I think the person who answered said, yeah, and I'm Robert Redford. But he called me and said that he really liked it and he'd like me to keep sending him what I wrote. So I did. And then at a certain point, he said, I've talked to my agents and they say you really have to live out here if you want to do this. And so I picked up and moved. And then after I had been out there doing typing and filing stuff for 11 months, he called me and said that MASH was looking to hire a new staff writer and he wanted them to hire a woman. So he got me an interview and I got the job.
And I wonder what you think that changed, how that helped your evolution as a writer, to have one of your first professional jobs as a writer be MASH.
It was overwhelming. And in fact, when my agent called to tell me they wanted to interview me for the job, I tried to turn it down because I said, it's MASH. You know, they'll fire me in 6 weeks. Because I can't do that. And so he said, well, if they fire you in 6 weeks, you'll live off of it forever. So he made me take the job, and I ended up staying there till the end of the show.
And you've written for all kinds of other TV shows, Hill Street Blues, Moonlighting, Roseanne. You've written episodes for Judging Amy and The Good Wife. Does writing TV shows help you or hurt you when it comes time to sit down and write a novel?
I feel like it helps me. You know, there are things that it helped and things that it didn't. It was interesting to me to not have people giving me notes because I'm so used to that. I'm used to writing, you know, with restrictions and with trying to match what somebody needs because it's a commercial art. And so is writing a book, but it wasn't so much like that. And my editor would give me notes, and if I didn't like his idea, he would say, okay, it's your book. And that never happens in television. So I liked the freedom of it. But I kind of, especially when I was writing this current edition, I didn't like the
fact current edition of Dark Debts.
Right. And I didn't like the fact that the only limits I really had were the limits of my own ability. And that's something that, you know, I don't want to spend every day of my life bumping up against. You know, this time I knew that this would be it. I'm not going to rewrite it again in 20 years. And so, you know, it could only be as good as I could make it. And that was scary.
Okay, so then tell me about when you very first began to write this novel. What would be your first, and until now, only novel? Why this subject matter? And I wonder, you were doing so much writing for other things, for other people's storylines. How did you land on this subject?
I had a friend whose mother was convinced that there was a demonic curse on their family, and I thought she had a case that would hold up in court because I knew details about the family. And I just thought that would be an interesting thing to look at. I thought, you know, could you make an intelligent case for that? And that's where I started.
And you ended up with what became a bestseller. What was that like the first time around? Did you feel before it went to the printing press that the book, that you were finished with it, that you were happy with it?
No, actually, because I wrote myself into a corner because I knew that if the book had lasted for a few more days, that my protagonist would have made a different decision. But I had written him as someone who didn't learn fast and wasn't going to turn on a dime. So I was kind of stuck with where he ended up at the end of the book. But what I thought at the time was I'll write a sequel and I'll finish it. And then I tried to write a sequel, and I have a file drawer full of chapter ones for the sequel, but it just never went anywhere. And then when I got a chance to rewrite it, I could do what I wanted to with that character.
So then that begs the question, if now you think you could. I mean, have you exercised your demons, pardon the pun?
With this novel?
Yeah.
I think so. I really, it's not on my mind like it used to be. And I feel pretty good about where I left it.
You changed the whole ending.
I did.
Don't tell us what it is.
I won't tell you the ending, but I'll tell you that part of the reason I changed it, I never quite felt right about it, but the main reason I changed it was because the ending was very internal in the book the first time, and it was in the characters' minds, and you know, I'm always now writing with the idea of this could be a movie, too. So I knew I had to do something to fix the fact that the ending wasn't too internal. So I went back and wrote something that you could film.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Hall. She's the author of the novel Dark Debts. The book came out 20 years ago. It was a bestseller, but Karen has rewritten it and released a new version. Now, you just said that you don't think about the novel now as much as you used to. What has that been like for 20 years? How often did you think about this novel?
Way too often, and it was really distracting because I had other ideas for novels that I wanted to write, and I just could not get that one out of my head.
But what was that like when you sat down to write something else? What would happen?
It's hard to say. It wasn't so much when I sat down. It was just that the character would just pop into my head all the time. And usually when I write a character, by the time I'm finished with the project, I'm done with that character. So, you know, he kept coming back to me, and, you know, I felt kind of haunted by the character.
And so that is not happening anymore?
No.
Have you sat down to write since
then? I'm writing a lot of things right now, but they're all television and movies. So I am too busy right now to think about writing another novel. But I think when I do sit down to do it again, my head will be clear.
Because it sounds like you already feel like it's clearer.
I do.
Do you feel as though the next book might be your sequel at last, or are you going to move on?
Oh, no. I'm not going to write a sequel. I'm done with these people. So I'm going to move on and write something else.
So before you're done with them, let me ask you a little bit about the extra research you did for this book in particular, because as I understand it, you came to Georgia and spent quite a bit of time here.
I actually bought a house here. I bought a farm in Polk County near Rome. And I always, while I'm writing for television, I always try to have a place that is somewhere else in what I think of as normal territory, because L.A. is just its own thing. And especially in the Southeast, because that's where I came from and that's what I love. And I set the book in Atlanta because I'd never been to Atlanta, and I knew I'd have to go to the place where I set the book, and I wanted to go to Atlanta. So I ended up falling in love with it and buying a farm, which I had for many years.
And you spent some time with some death row inmates. Why?
I did. Well, the person who gave me the idea, whose mother gave me the idea for the book, had a brother who had been executed. And I wanted to make sure the character was more a composite character. And so I wanted to meet other families of people with relatives on death row. And so that's what I did. And I spent time talking to the person because I also had to be able to understand to write the criminal.
And can you tell me what that conversation was like with the publisher? Because I understand it. The publisher came to you and said, hey, let's reissue this book.
Well, my publisher is John Karp, who published the first edition at Random House, and then this edition is at Simon & Schuster. And he had mentioned to me somewhere in the last 20 years that he had always wanted to take a book that a writer had written and let them go back and rewrite it many years later to see how it would change. And when he said that, it stuck in my mind, and I didn't think, let's do my book, but I thought that was an interesting concept. So I actually had someone was trying to buy the rights to the book to do an audio drama, and it looked like it was going forward. It actually didn't, but I called John and said, this is happening, so you might want to, release the book again. And so we realized that it would be the 20th anniversary, and so I said, you know that thing you said about you would like to have somebody go back and rewrite their book? Could that be me? And he said, yes.
Are you prepared for readers to say they liked the first version better?
I don't have a problem with that. And the thing about a book is I also owned a bookstore until very recently. And the thing about a book is, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. Some people are going to prefer the first book, and some people are going to prefer the second. And when I give them out now, I kind of explain to them what the differences are to see which one they want.
And is it now okay for you to talk to your sister Barbara about Dark Debts?
About the book? I don't know. I don't think we really have anything else to say about it. I talk to her mostly about show business and how to survive it.
Oh, so you don't actually need a mediator at Thanksgiving dinner anymore?
No, we don't really.
Okay, so is this going to be the habit, Karen, except for TV work, when you sit down to write stuff, are you going to be a chronic rewriter?
Oh, I am a chronic rewriter. And when it's television, you know, I rewrite until they wrench it out of my hands because they have to shoot it. Because I'm just a perfectionist and I never stop working on it.
So that might happen with your next novel also?
It might, but I'm going to try to, even in this rewrite, I try to not be like that because I just get so bogged down in it.
Well, good luck with your next book.
Thank you.
Whenever you can start that. What TV and movie projects are you working on? Can you tell me?
Not really. I'm working on a screenplay that's based on a woman's real life story, and I'm working on a miniseries that I can tell you that is based on the unsaintly years of St. Ignatius, which were very unsaintly. And then I'm working on a TV project that I can't talk about, but it will be high profile, so you'll see it if it comes to fruition.
Well, she has been nominated for an Emmy 7 times, so she knows what she's doing. Karen Hall just re-released her novel, Dark Debts, new characters, a new ending. Karen, thank you so much. And you know what? Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's our show for today. And we wanted... Is there something in your life that you've always wanted to go back and do over? Maybe it wasn't a novel. Maybe it was a decorating project or an essay or a conversation. That's common. What would you redo if you could? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can leave a message there. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, "Devil, just come on back if you ever want to try again. Cause I told you once, you son of a gun, I'm the best there's ever been." He played, "Found him out, run, boy, run. Devil's in the house of the rising sun. A chicken in the bread, fella, picking out dough. Ready when you don't find no child.